Good morning. I'm Nancy Collins here on behalf of James Pye. If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Mr. Fye's conviction should be reversed due to a number of evidentiary errors, as well as defense counsel's unreasonable stipulation to the admission of otherwise inadmissible evidence that the state relied on, both to bolster its case and as a separate basis to convict him. One of the principal evidentiary errors in this case was using having a therapist repeat the complainant's out-of-court statements, which are hearsay, and not admissible under the ER 803A4, the exception for statements made for the purpose of medical treatment or diagnosis.
Now, one of the arguments the state makes is that Mr. Fayes waived his right to challenge the admissibility of that evidence. What's your response to that?
That is incorrect, that he objected that in the first volume of reports, pages 16 through 21, the prosecutor begins a conversation on this very issue, and the prosecutor had also briefed this issue as part of his motions in limine, acknowledging that it was rare. In fact, he didn't think that it had been a long time that his office had ever tried to present this sort of child hearsay through a therapist, but he was asking the court to permit that exception here, urging the court to treat it like a medical doctor's statement or out-of-court statements by a medical doctor. The court did not issue a tentative ruling on this. Defense counsel, but at the same time, objected, saying that the trial was court-ordered, that it's on page 19, that it seemed like the purpose was part of the dependency proceeding. The child was compelled to go by the court, and it was not, therefore, the child's purpose to seek treatment or to make statements in the context of treatment.
So what did the court rule?
Well, and the court ruled that as long as the state issued as long as the state elicited evidence that from the therapist's point of view, the purpose was treatment, that it would be admissible. And that legal error is our basic point here, that the court was applying the wrong standard when determining that this information would be admissible, because it was not the therapist's point of view but the declarant's point of view that would matter. So the court premised its ruling on applying the wrong standard.
So you apparently just said that you believe that the court made a final ruling in that motion in limine.
Yes, the court made a final ruling, and that ruling was premised on the wrong legal standard.
And so you had no duty to make another objection at the time the evidence was actually proffered.
Yes, that is exactly our point, that this pretrial discussion preserved the issue, and the court made a final ruling. There was no affirmative evidence that the child KR had a treatment motive when attending these court-mandated sessions with this therapist. In fact, her testimony was to the contrary.
So we should never admit that testimony if it comes from a child?
I think that there's plenty of case law on this issue. If you look at the Carroll MD case and Kilgore, which affirmed that.
But children don't elect to go to treatment. They're sent there by parents or the court or somebody else. So is that really the wrong standard here?
Like
an adult.
As the court said, in Carroll MD, they were dealing, it was in Kilgore, were also children seeing doctors, and the court said when you have a situation where the declarant doesn't know what this person is doing, or doesn't know that this is for the purpose of treatment and the treatment is there to benefit her, I mean, that the rationale underlying the rule is that when someone goes to a doctor, you know that if you don't speak accurately, you're not going to get the right diagnosis and you're going to do yourself harm, so you have the incentive to speak truthfully.
So with children, it's not the threshold of did they choose to go for that, but when they get there, are they informed and do they understand? So it's later.
Yes, and that you can infer from potentially the nature of the conversation there, or for the child's testimony about it. But that didn't happen in this case.
There wasn't an offer about the child's testimony at that stage.
There was discussion. I'm sorry, then the preservation issue, is that what you're referring to? There was discussion about the child being court-ordered and the purpose being to elicit information from the dependency. The judge reacted to that by saying, well, in my personal experience, no one would ever send a child to therapy for a purpose other than to benefit the child, presuming that. But then that's the perspective, again, of the therapist, they're being there to serve the child, and not the perspective that the court should have been viewing the evidence or the motion in limine from, which was what the declarant would have understood or did understand the purpose to be.
So if the evidence later offered didn't bear that out, was an objection required? Or another challenge to say, okay, your ruling that the child understood what they were there for is not supported by the evidence?
Well, it wasn't required here because the court said the threshold would be the therapist's perspective. So, and that was borne out. I mean, the therapist thought she was there to provide treatment and services and whatnot to the child. So under the court's rule and the pretrial rule, which was a firm ruling, that it would be admitted if this threshold was made, that threshold was made, so it wouldn't be preservation-wise necessary.
So defense counsel was hamstrung based on the inaccurate legal ruling, is your position?
Yes, that is. And this was evidence that was very much relied on by the state in their closing argument in terms of just the substantive evidence to prove the allegation, as well as to bolster the child's credibility, which was essentially the crux of the case. And I know I don't have a lot of time left, but a similar problem with bolstering and, in fact, providing additional substantive evidence occurred with the admission of that videotape, which was otherwise inadmissible, and parties agreed to that, had defense counsel not stipulated to the full wholesale admission of that. In fact, the jury was given the DVD of that video to watch at free will during deliberations.
And that's the challenge to the assistance of counsel.
Yes.
So, and you're arguing ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, on that point, yes, we are. And that was, again, very much relied on. The prosecutor encouraged the jury to view it carefully, and that provided, and in fact, could base the whole verdict on an allegation from that video that wasn't testified to at all, because there were multiple acts alleged in the video, and the prosecutor said that video alone would be sufficient.
May it please the Court, I'm Kathleen Weber, and I represent the State of Washington. There are two issues that have been argued here today with respect to Mr. Fye's conviction for child molestation in the first degree. The first is whether or not what has to do with the admission of evidence through Joe Jordan, the therapist, under the statements made for medical diagnosis and treatment. And the other has to do with the question of ineffective assistance of counsel for stipulating to otherwise inadmissible evidence. With respect to the first question, I think the key issue for the court here is whether or not the issue has been preserved. In this particular case, the objection from defense counsel was along the lines of whether or not court-ordered therapy was never for the purposes of diagnosis and treatment. And the trial court, drawing in on its own experience as a guardian ad litem and then commissioner and then judge, said, no, that's not the case. That's what the court made a final ruling on. What it did not make a final ruling on and what it made clear by saying if additional foundation is developed, then it can come in. What it made clear was that it was not a final ruling, that the state was still held to its standard of laying the foundation for the purposes of medical diagnosis and treatment, and that's a two-part foundation. It's a foundation that's based upon the perception of the declarant, and it's a foundation based upon the perception of the therapist.
So what was the testimony related to the declarant, and how did that meet the foundation that was required?
Well, it's my position, Your Honor, that issue has not been preserved.
And if we disagreed with that, what was the foundation that was
Well, you can look at the totality of the circumstances from what the child testified to and what the therapist testified to. We know from both witnesses that this child did not make any statements until she was about 6 months into therapy. And she talked a lot about her feelings toward the offender, in this case, Mr. Fye. She talked about other things. The defense has plucked one phrase out of a sentence to say that her understanding was this was to get her ready for court. There are two things that the court should consider in respect to that. Number one, that isn't the totality of what she testified to. She did talk a lot about her feelings. The therapist did talk a lot about the fact that part of therapy was helping her get over and deal with what happened to her. Well, part of what's happening to her is that she has to testify at trial. And the last thing Joe Jordan testified to was that therapy is done when the child is able to talk about what happened to her without breaking down. Well, certainly if she can't talk about what happened to her without breaking down, she's not ready for trial. She's not ready to testify. So even taking into consideration what the defense says, suggests that this is not for purposes of treatment, it in fact is, because part of dealing with what happened to her is going before a number of strangers and explaining what happened to her in a very detailed and intimate way. So I think you look at the totality of the circumstances. You look at what Ms. Jordan told the child. There's certainly nothing about what this child said or did that suggests that she is anything other than normal intelligence. There's case authority that says you can look at the circumstance of the age of the child, this child being 10 years old during the time of the therapy, that child would understand that, you know, given the length of the time that she's talking to this therapist, given the subject matter that they're talking about, that she would have understood that this was for the purposes of getting her more comfortable and dealing with what happened to her, including the fallout from what happened to her.
So it's your position that the defendant should have objected to and moved to strike either all or portions of the therapist's testimony in order to meet its duty to preserve?
I think the only thing that they're really talking about here that, with respect to Ms. Jordan's testimony is the testimony regarding what K.R. said about 6 months afterwards regarding the defendant touching her in a particular way and that she didn't even know she was disclosing at the time she disclosed, which happened about 6 months after she started therapy. And yes, that is my position, that the defense should have, at that point, interposed an objection. Now, the defense has also argued that the defendant was essentially hamstrung, or defense counsel was essentially hamstrung because the court used the wrong standard. But it's incumbent upon the defense attorney to say, Judge, it's not just from the therapist's opinion, therapist's position, it's also from the child's position, so that the court can then have an opportunity to correct itself. That's the whole point of issue preservation, is allowing the court to have an opportunity to fully consider the legalities of the circumstance. Another problem with this issue preservation question is that...
So do you concede that the court's ruling did not include the two-part analysis that you've talked about, which is from the perspective of the declarant and from the perspective of the therapist?
Certainly he did not articulate that first part of the analysis, no. But it could have been corrected had the defense interposed an appropriate objection either then or at the time that the state elicited the testimony. The other problem with issue preservation is that if the defense had truly believed that the foundation had not been laid and interposed an objection, then this whole issue of whether or not what the child, the sentence that they're picking out to say that it's from her perspective, it was not for treatment, then it could have been explored right then and there at court. I mean, this child went through 9 months of therapy before she testified. So what is it that she's talking about when she says to get me ready for court? Is she talking about that specific, well, we know she was talking about that specific conversation that she had about the mechanics of trial with Ms. Jordan, because then she explained that. But when she was talking about what happened to her, is that necessarily what she meant when she said, is that getting me for trial? Probably not, when you look at the entire context of it. But it certainly could have been developed if the defense had interposed an appropriate objection at the time.
So are you saying that whether the child knew she was in treatment was the foundation?
That's part of the foundation. I mean, certainly it was developed from Ms. Jordan that whatever the child told to her was for the purposes of diagnosis and treatment.
I think in part is, was the only objection to be made at trial that the foundation hadn't been laid, therefore the issue is gone, and there's no legal
that would have
error.
Been the
or if if the objection isn't that, is it, again, a different objection? And what would it be?
Right. I mean, the objection would have been that it has not been clearly stated. I mean, it's essentially what they're arguing on appeal now, is that it wasn't clearly stated that this child understood that what she was talking about when she was talking about the abuse was for the purposes of diagnosis and treatment. That would have been the proper objection, which was not interposed.
And if the defendant did not waive or preserve the error, what's your argument about the testimony? How critical was it? How much did the prosecutor rely on it?
Well, it was one piece of the puzzle. I mean, one of the arguments that the state made is that the child has been consistent throughout. And that was a one-time incident where she did consistently say, he touched me in my vaginal region. But again, there was other testimony. There was her in-court testimony, and then there was the videotape. I'd like to go on to the videotape just for a moment in response to that. This was part of a reasonable strategic decision to allow in this otherwise inadmissible evidence. This is not a question of whether or not defense counsel did not make himself adequately aware of the relevant law and facts. He did interview the child. He was aware of the discovery, and he was aware of the law. But the whole defense in this case was that KR was an attention-seeking child. She discovered during the course of this Open Door Theater production that she could get attention by saying that the same thing happened to her. Within hours of this happening, she gave a fairly detailed interview to the child interview specialist, and that played a key role in the defense, because the defense is that this was just a fabrication, and when she cannot give a detailed analysis, a detailed explanation of what happened, that's evidence that she can't keep her lies straight. The defense could not have made that argument without that videotape, and it doesn't make a difference if it was allowed in for substantive or impeachment purposes. In fact, it might have been strategic to allow it in for substantive purposes to give it the full impact. Because if the jury bought the defense argument, they're going to discount, the theory is, it would discount not only what she said in the video, but what she says in court, and they would have acquitted. So for those reasons, I'm asking the court to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just to clarify a little bit on the objection to Ms. Jordan's testimony, it wasn't, although the most damaging part of Ms. Jordan's testimony was certainly when she went into detail about repeating what KR said about these specific allegations that make up this charge. She also repeated a number of other things that KR had said that the state used in its closing argument as a reason why you should believe KR. And they're all hearsay that would not otherwise have been admissible.
Now, the child's in this counseling therapy for 7 months. It's just hard to accept that that's 7 months of trial preparation.
I don't think that our only argument is not that that her testimony was she thought the reason she was there was to prepare herself for court, and perhaps they probably discussed getting her comfortable for being in court. And there's also a dependency proceeding going on, so there might have been court proceedings that they talked about with that too. But that was not the only reason.
Okay, but isn't the record that it arose in the dependency and that there's 7 months there? Doesn't that go to the foundation for the fact that the statements are not being prepared solely for preparation for court and undercut your argument of legal error?
The KR was clear and the discussion was clear that she was court-mandated to attend these sessions. There was no dispute that she didn't ever like going. She had to go once a week. She didn't want to go. She didn't really like talking to Ms. Jordan. And she herself said, she didn't like to be there and thought she's only being there to prepare herself for court, which doesn't generate the truthful seeking of treatment that the evidence rule contemplates as an exception to the hearsay rules. Ms. Jordan didn't insist on truthfulness. There's not testimony that she's instructed that she must tell the truth here. She's, in fact, told that the court's going to hear if she says anything alleging criminal activity, that would be relayed. It wouldn't be private, which in other cases has been used to undercut the notion that it is simply for the truth that these statements are being made. And so under these circumstances, there's reason to believe that KR didn't have that necessary motivation that underlies this hearsay rule that would let the court admit this in critical testimony. And I just refer you to the bottom of page 21 in the first reported proceedings for the firmness of the court's rule that it would be admissible as long as it met the perspective of the therapist's purpose for being for treatment.
And so the argument is, well, defense counsel should have objected and said, Your Honor, that's not the legal standard. You also have to look at the declarant. What's your response to that?
Well, I think if you look at the context in which this arose, they had briefing on case law about this. The prosecutor made an argument that it's always admissible just as a medical doctor's defense attorney said, well, we shouldn't be so quick to admit it here when she was court mandated to do it and her purpose related to that court mandate. And the court issued this ruling about the therapist's perspective. So in that context, it's a firm ruling. It was preserved, and the purpose of the preservation rule was met in this case. Thank you very much.